Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Second Opinion with me, Dr. Christian. This is your weekly podcast prescription, the only dose of anything that you'll ever need to give you all the knowledge and health and happiness. Is that over exaggeration, Alex? What do you think?
No, I think
is that pushing it? Can I get away with it? I am duty bound to say that if you feel unwell at any point during this podcast, don't carry on listening. Make contact with a doctor, either by dialing NHS 111, consulting your GP, or visiting your local hospital. Right, that's the legal bit done. Let's move seamlessly on with the show. Alex, forceps, retractor.
Here you go, dear.
Thank you. As always, I am joined by Alex Stanger. That's the voice you hear. How are you, Alex? What
I'm
news?
Very well indeed. I was a little bit asleep when you were doing the intro. I was sort of like dreaming about something else. And now I'm in the room.
Who were you
I
dreaming
am here
about?
In the room.
Are you back with us?
I was actually thinking... Yeah, I'm back.
All right.
I'm back.
You're not going to say
I'm not going to say.
About.
No, I'm definitely right. Not going to say.
And this week on Second Opinion, I've very particularly wanted to talk about HIV. We haven't done it yet, have we? And
no.
It's high time that we did. And so... my guest for today, I'm really happy to say, is Chief Exec of the Terence Higgins Trust, Ian Green. Ian, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Christian.
Welcome.
It's nice to be here.
Thank you for agreeing to come. I know you're a very busy man. You've now got the HIV Commission as well.
We do. That's a national independent commission that is focused on how we can end new HIV transmissions in the UK. Because we think we've got all of the tools in the toolbox to make it happen. But what we need is some fresh thinking to think how they might all come together to make that a reality. Who'd have thought we could be thinking now about the possibility of ending new HIV transmission?
I remember doing talks for you guys for THT at various fundraisers and saying exactly that and thinking, what a profound thing to be able to stand here,
You
know, and say to a group of people that there should be no more new HIV transmissions, it's perfectly possible. It sort of sent little shivers down my spine as I said that. Mm. But were you aware of that, Alex?
No, I wasn't aware of that at all. So I'm a child of the 80s.
Yep.
And of course, that was when we had those adverts that were horrific. And to think that in relatively short space of time that we're in this position, that must be... that's pretty incredible. Is it as incredible as one thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember those adverts
I mean,
as
it was
well.
Doom. And we were all going. We were all on that train and we were going to be hit by that iceberg, weren't we?
Yeah, the tombstone crashing down. Then a bunch of lilies get thrown onto the top of the tombstone. And, I mean, for the time, it was a really powerful, impactful public information and awareness.
Scared the crap out of us, let's be honest,
didn't
it?
Scared the crap out of everybody.
Yeah.
And the challenge with that is, for many people, that's still their narrative. You know, they haven't got up-to-date information about how things have changed so radically, so dramatically in the last 30 years, where we can now say that somebody who's diagnosed with HIV today, if they get onto treatment, they can have a normal life expectancy. But also, really importantly, if somebody has an undetectable viral load, that means the amount of the virus in their blood can't be detected. It's impossible for them to transmit the virus to their sexual partners. And so that's amazing news. We're doing our very best to try and get that information out there. But the challenge is that many people's narrative is stuck back in the 1980s.
It is. You say that. However, I was talking to a younger person than myself. She was in her 20s. And I don't know how we got onto it, but we got onto condoms and sexually transmitted diseases. And she said, we don't even worry about that. And I was absolutely gobsmacked because when I was single, and you'd maybe meet someone, and when the mummy, daddy,
oh, you're going all, you know, coy,
when all that, I know I'm getting a bit coy, but you know, when,
listeners,
when
she's
I put
blushing.
It,
she's
when
blushing
I put it about a bit, you know, that you wouldn't even think about, you would not think about having sex without a condom because you were so terrified. Yeah. Now, is that a generational thing? That because I was absolutely gobsmacked that she said, I said, what about HIV? In a really panicked tone, and she said, I don't even think about that. Yeah. Why would I think about that?
Do you know, it's one of the things that I am constantly reminded of in the role that I do is when I was growing up, condom use was something that was ingrained into you. We now do lots of work with young people, and it's very similar to what you're saying, is that very few young people would automatically think about the importance of condom use, but also they wouldn't link that at all to HIV. Other STIs maybe, but not to HIV. And so many people's minds, HIV is a thing of the past. And what we need to remind people of is that whilst we believe we can get to zero new HIV transmissions, there are still over 4,500 people a year who are diagnosed with HIV, and many of those are young people. So, you know, it hasn't gone away. And that's so important that we've got opportunities like this to make people aware of what the current situation is with HIV, but also how things have changed, and actually we can be hopeful and optimistic.
And Ian, you are, I mean, you yourself are HIV positive, and you've talked about this before, haven't you?
Yeah.
When were you diagnosed?
I was diagnosed in 1996. I've been living with HIV for 23 years now. When I was diagnosed, I thought it was like having a rug pulled from under my feet. And I thought at that point in time, perhaps I might have 8 years left to live. Antiretroviral therapy, the drugs that you take to treat HIV, were just becoming available, but the side effects for them were pretty awful at that point in time. And so I was planning for death at that point in time, and I'd seen many of my friends die, and die quite horribly. And so it was quite a real impact on anyone's life to have that positive diagnosis, and still is today.
Were you diagnosed early or late? Do you know?
I was diagnosed really early. I had a seroconversion illness. That's when you get HIV, your immune system reacts. And so I felt really rough for a couple of weeks. And so within 3 months of that seroconversion illness, I was diagnosed by my GP, actually. So not in a
That's quite unusual,
healthcare.
Actually.
Very unusual, yeah. So,
How old were you at the time?
I was 31, right. 31, 32.
And then I imagine that diagnosis, not only for you mentally and thinking, God, I've got this death sentence ahead of me, but it would affect your relationships as well, or the thought of going into relationships. I mean, how did it affect you?
It impacts every area of your life, probably. Certainly did for me then. The first thing I had to think through is, who was I going to tell? I have a very good, close network of friends, and they were incredibly supportive. My GP was actually a friend, and so he told me that I had the HIV positive diagnosis and was incredibly supportive and caring. The hardest thing was telling my parents. That was just a shocker. And just to see how they were really just concerned about me. I was worried that they were going to react in a really negative way. They were incredible. But to see the pain on their face as I told them about the fact I was living with HIV. And then it was about, do I tell work? Do I tell, you know, when I'm getting into new relationships, at what stage do you have that conversation with somebody you want to have sex with about the fact that you're HIV positive? I mean, it's so complicated, and it meshes into all sorts of different areas of your life. And so the impact was huge. Things have got much easier since then, and I'm very open about my status, but I can understand how people still are reluctant to share their status, and I faced stigma and discrimination, often in a medical setting, I've got to say, it's still something that's very real and very relevant.
So one of the reasons I went into sexual health and HIV as a doctor was, this will sound slightly crass, but bear with me, is first of all, it was a new and exciting disease. I'm aware of how crass that sounds, but, you know, it's not eczema or asthma and things like this. This was a new thing that you could follow the research. I could relate to the patients. They were from my same demographic usually, and I could converse with them and, you know, hopefully, you know, do some good for them and put them at ease, not make them feel alienated, which so many of my colleagues did. And I remember being on a ward round, actually, as a medical student, and it was at UCL, and there's a whole floor there for inpatients with AIDS, as it was called at that time. And I remember none of us going anywhere near the patient. And it's a thing of profound shame for me now, actually, that we would all stand gowned, masked, end of the bed, as far away as possible, and talk to this poor chap in the bed. And it makes me shudder with utter shame now. But we didn't know. And I wanted to talk about sort of milestones in changing that. And for me, there were two really, really important things. There was Diana. Mm. You know, and however staged and produced it may have been, or whatever her motives might have been, nevertheless, she sat on the bed, she shook hands with, she hugged people with AIDS. And that really sort of shamed all us doctors who wouldn't go near, for a start, and really started to change things, didn't it?
She had a profound impact. I mean, the London Lighthouse, which was then part of Terence Higgins Trust, she used to go in and visit privately. The staff used to get a telephone call from the palace to say she'd like to pop in. Normally, sort of late in the evening, she would, her car would be parked round the side. She'd be brought in a back door, and she'd just spend hours chatting to people in the inpatient area of the London Lighthouse. And for many of them, that was something that was easing their final few days and months of their life. Some of them were ostracised from their family. Mm. Many of them were really scared and worried. And to have somebody like Princess Diana to show that she cared, not only publicly but also privately, that had a massive impact. And the shaking of the hand, the hugging, the speaking out, the advocacy was so important. And she did a huge amount. And you know, I know that she would have carried on that work had she not died so tragically.
But I think it's interesting that her son, actually, Harry, has a similar impact, I think. So Harry on YouTube or on, where was
on
it?
On YouTube, yeah.
On YouTube, you know, did an HIV test live on camera.
Facebook. It was on Facebook.
On Facebook. Yeah. I mean, that's no member of royalty has ever done anything like that, ever, I don't think, have they? And that was, again, sort of, one doesn't want to say following his mother's shoes because it's such a boring old cliche, but it was a, again, as profound a thing to do, I think, a gesture to change opinion and to try and encourage openness and discussion and testing that I've ever seen. I just wish it had been me doing it with him.
Well, it did more to normalise HIV testing than anything else. Mm. I mean, when he took that test, we knew that was going to happen a few days in advance. And we saw a 500% increase in people ordering self-testing kits on our website over the sort of the 2 and 3 day period after he took the test. Mm. And, you know, one of the things that is so important about ending new HIV transmissions is to normalise HIV testing and encourage more people to get tested. It's so easy to get tested now. Mm. You can get tested, you know, in a sexual health clinic through your GP. You can do your own test at home and you have the results immediately, or you can send the blood back to a lab. So there's so many different ways. You can be tested in a community setting, at sports clubs and community centres, in church settings. HIV testing is accessible anywhere, but we need to make sure that people feel that they're confident and comfortable to get tested. And one of the things that is holding people back is the stigma that's still associated with HIV.
I was going to ask, do you still think there is a stigma associated with it? Because we all thought it was from you being, I don't know, it's the usual, the shame of having sex, I suppose, or the shame of...
Well, my favourite subject, shame, isn't
shame,
it?
Yeah. So is there still a stigma, do you think, attached to HIV?
I think it's probably one of the most stigmatised health conditions that there has ever been. Mm. And there's still a huge amount of stigma associated with people living with HIV. We did a piece of research a couple of years ago now around growing old with HIV. And so who'd have thought, actually, people would be growing old with HIV, which is fantastic news. But now people are beginning to have to chart the sort of the whole issue of getting into residential care when they're getting older. People living with HIV have some particular challenges there. And we heard a story of a care home not far from West London, where a woman living with HIV was discouraged from leaving her room. If she did leave her room, she was encouraged to sit just in one seat. And when she used the television remote control, they came and wiped it with an antiseptic wipe. And that was just in 2017. I had a carpal tunnel operation on my wrist a couple of years ago, and always talked to the nurse about my HIV status, and I had to have some blood taken. I looked at the form as I was wandering off to phlebotomy, and suddenly I noticed on it she'd stamped high risk on my, the form. And I was so shocked, I didn't even challenge it at that point in time, and I should have done. Going to the dentist, that there's still stories of people that the dentist will only see people at the end of the day, and will come out dressed like a spaceman still,
yeah.
And will often wrap their equipment in cling film. And so there is stigma that people face in relationships, in employment, from families, unfortunately still, but also in a healthcare setting. So stigma is still probably the biggest barrier stopping people from getting tested for HIV.
It can be an internalised stigma as well. I talk a lot about sort of internalised homophobia in say, gay men who... And they do have a double whammy. There's first, I'm gay and I have to come out. And then there's, I have HIV and I have to come out about that as well. Or I'm forced to come out, you know, by various organisations. I think it's very important to remember that HIV can affect anyone, you know, all demographics. And I, as a doctor, have diagnosed it so many times in heterosexual men and women and diagnosed it late. They've, you know, really shockingly, actually, they've seen a lot of people, including specialists, and no one's really known what's wrong with them. And they've come into my surgery, you know, and within 10 seconds, you know exactly what's wrong with them. Only just because it's always in the back of my mind, and I think it's not in the back. But to forget that actually as a heterosexual man or woman, you are not as much as risk, but still at risk, is really important. And I think they're the ones who really get missed, aren't they, these days?
They are. I mean, gay men who have sex with men, there is, certainly with gay men, there is a good culture of HIV testing. Not with everybody, but with many. The other largest group that is impacted in the UK is people from the Black African community. And again, a lot of work has been done over the course of the last couple of years to make sure that testing is targeted at that group as well.
And the stigma in that particular group
different.
Is huge,
isn't it? And your messaging needs to be so different from the other demographic of gay men, to often a very conservative group of people. And so using faith leaders is really important about them encouraging people to get tested. I mean, I would always say to people, do you know your status? Do you know your status? And it's something that perhaps is really important that we all have a responsibility to be aware of.
Would you, in a perfect world, like to see them mandatory, a test?
I don't like mandatory anything,
okay.
To be honest.
Right.
I think that people need to be absolutely comfortable and confident about getting tested. If somebody is sexually active, I would encourage somebody to have a HIV test. I mean, they can order a self-test kit at a cheap rate on Terence Higgins Trust website today. And it's really easy and really straightforward. And for the vast majority of people, that will just be reassuring to them.
Mm.
But if somebody is HIV positive, the sooner they get into treatment, the better their outcome in terms of their longevity and their health. But really importantly, they need to get onto treatment to get an undetectable viral load so they can't transmit the virus on. And that's one of the reasons one of the ways that we're going to end new HIV transmissions.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
We talked about the stigma just a minute ago. Do you have to disclose that you're HIV positive to an employer?
No.
Right.
Or insurance.
Or insurance.
Or insurance?
No, not anymore.
Quite right,
I'm quite surprised by that, but I'm pleased about it.
That's one of the many myths. I'm glad you asked that, that I think people still worry about and probably, you know, puts them off getting tested, actually.
So when did that all change then?
Oh, about, in terms of the employer, you've never had to disclose to an employer. There have been some areas in terms of being a clinical, I guess, I don't know whether doctors still do need to.
We'll use this rather unfortunate phrase, hands inside cavities.
That's right. That's
if you
right.
put your hands into body cavities for a job, never mind your private life, but for a job, then you ought to disclose it because potentially there is a risk. Again, that will probably change because that risk is now minimal.
The chief medical officer who stepped down recently, that she announced a couple of years ago, there's actually no reason anymore if somebody is on treatment with an undetectable viral load because of the risk of transmission is zero. So, but there is still that, I guess, some would feel an obligation on clinicians.
I suspect it's more to keep patients feeling comfortable than it is. But that's not a reason, actually, because I think that spreads misinformation still. It doesn't correct an incorrect perception, you know?
The only challenge with insurance is that you don't have to declare, but it can be quite challenging to get life insurance still. And that's something that we still need to campaign over. And that's a real issue for many people. They can get insurance, but the premiums are much, much higher. And there's some really good LGBT insurance companies who are passionate about getting that message out there and to challenge the industry.
When was, and sorry, this is going back to really earlier on, when was the change? When did HIV become something that wasn't the death sentence that we all thought it was going to be?
Started in 1996 when antiretroviral therapy was started to become available. And that's when you started to see people who were ill. It's actually, it was almost Lazarus-like for some people that they'd been very, very sick and suddenly they started antiretroviral therapy and they started to get better.
You could walk down the street and spot people with HIV in those days. Now, I absolutely cannot. Yeah. You know, you can't play the game of diagnose people on the tube anymore. Well, not for HIV, for other things, but not for that. And that's extraordinary, actually. Yeah. And so quickly, in so terms quickly. Of research, so
yes,
quickly.
Yes, it does seem like a very quick thing. Like when we talk about so many different things on this podcast, this it feels like this is one that was, I don't want to say cracked, but it was one that seems to have developed very quickly.
I think you know we got Liz Taylor and Michael Jackson holding great fundraisers, and
that's the thing. Was it that and it went back to Princess Diana? I was thinking having a face like that, who was empathetic and so high profile. Did that help in a way to get the research done, to get these drugs through, to get the therapy that was required?
I'm sure that did have an impact, but also it was down to activism as well. People raised money, but activists were really saying, we demand
you've got to get this
people take action. Yeah. And you know, we're really fortunate today to have really strong celebrity supporters. I mean, Christian, you've done so much as a clinician to make sure this is maintained within the networks that you have. And thank you for what you do. And other people are constantly looking to work with us to make sure that the message doesn't get lost. People like Stephen Fry, Elton John, Beverly Knight, a credible array of people who we're very fortunate to have associated with us as patrons or celebrity supporters. So keeping it in the public eye is so important. When I told Prince Harry that we had such a massive increase in self-testing, he blushed. And he's great, and he's hopefully going to be doing something for us again for HIV Testing Week.
Oh, exciting. Watch this space. But I can't, say it enough. It's such an important thing that he did. And I think all the people, you can, add a healthy dose of cynicism to people's motivations, you know, for holding galas and whatever they want to do. But it raised an awful lot of money, it raised an awful lot of awareness, and it got us, arguably, to where we are now, which is, you know, people with HIV being able to live normal life expectancies. There are a lot of, I think, really moving stories about, particularly in the research. When I was working out in Kenya and Uganda, and that was the time when they were looking into a group of, it was Ugandan sex workers, who were absolutely the highest risk possible for getting HIV, and yet they weren't. And we couldn't work out why this was. They were never changing positive. And they gave their permission to, you know, have blood taken and have cells taken and researched. And they have a mutation in a certain cell receptor that meant HIV couldn't bind to their CD4 cells. And from, you know, this was a sort of a milestone, I think, in developing new therapies. We then realized, right, if we develop a drug that does the same thing, that blocks that receptor, we might be able to stop HIV binding. It didn't stop, unfortunately, people becoming positive quite in those terms, but it developed a whole new, you know, range of medications. And that was one of those extraordinary stories of a really sort of dispossessed and stigmatized minority group of, you know, Ugandan sex workers, the bottom rung of the bottom rung, suddenly actually was sort of played a part in saving lives. It was a wonderful story.
Can I ask, and this might put a downer on it, but are people still dying from AIDS? That's really base. I'm sorry, but it's one of my...
Question.
Are people still dying in this country from AIDS?
So there'll be about just over 200 deaths each year attributable to HIV directly. But nobody needs to die of HIV, an AIDS-related illness in the UK today. It's absolutely not necessary. And the reason that there are those deaths is because people are diagnosed late, often when they're very sick, and often it's population groups that people you wouldn't associate with HIV, as Christian was saying earlier. So heterosexual men and women, maybe, you know, somebody who lives in a rural community who wouldn't even think they've been at risk, but had a sexual partner many years ago who perhaps had a sexual partner who was living with HIV, infected them, then they've been living with HIV for 10, 15 years, suddenly become very sick, often still get PCP and pneumonia, and then their lungs give up on them and they unfortunately die. So, yes, there are still deaths from AIDS in the UK. Globally, still about 1 million people die of AIDS every year. Again, people don't need to die of HIV anymore because we have all of the drugs available to make sure that people can have their HIV treated.
It's not a crass question at all. It's a very important question because it is. There are still people dying and those people don't need to be dying. And it's those sort of, it's my lot, you know, it's my profession often who GPs, whoever it might be, you know, dismissing them because they just don't fit the demographic in their view, you know, and oh, I'm sure you're fine. Take some antibiotics, off you go. And also probably a degree of fear. Perhaps, you know, deep down, and I suspect a lot of people deep down, it's not that much of a surprise. It's a shock, but it's not necessarily a surprise. I think there's a difference, but there's a sort of, I'm going to put this off as long as I can because it's better.
Yes,
in their heads than knowing, but it's not better to not know.
The ostrich tendency kicks in sometimes.
Yeah.
And people would, I mean, certainly in the early days when there was no treatment, lots of people did that. I'd rather not know. I'd rather not know because of, I just want to carry on living my life without that, the burden of knowing I'm HIV. Even if I fear it, that is easier to bear than the burden of knowing. I mean, one of the challenges that we've got today is that older generation of people with HIV, many of whom thought they had very little time to live, they're often living in poverty because they cash in their pensions. They're isolated. Many of them will have PTSD because of the trauma of thinking they were going to die with this stigmatized condition, and now they're trying to chart the course of living but growing old with HIV. And so that's a group that at Terrent Higgins Trust we need to do more to make sure that we're supporting that demographic of people, because many people are doing really well with HIV today, but there is a group of people that actually are really struggling with HIV, and it's making sure all of that support is still there. And that's much harder because funding from the state is reduced quite significantly, and we need to make sure that we are raising the funds to continue the vital support, and often it's mental health issues that people are facing, to enable them to not just live well. I just don't want to live well. I want to thrive. Mm. And it's about making sure we've got the ability to thrive with HIV rather than just to do good.
HIV has, you know, inspired, I think, a lot of art and movements and plays and film and all sorts of things. I don't know if any of you saw it. This might be too dated. There was a pair of plays called The Inheritance. Did you see The Inheritance?
I did see The Inheritance.
The most extraordinary, moving, heartbreaking, but warm and inspiring play I think I've ever seen. If you ever get a chance to see The Inheritance, it's on in New York at the moment, and it will come back and it will come back and it will come back. But there have been a lot of pieces of art, movies, haven't there, inspired by HIV, that might be a good way for people who aren't really sure or think they're not infected, actually not affected, not infected, but affected by it, to be introduced gently to HIV as a subject. What do you think?
I think that the arts world has done a huge amount to respond to the HIV epidemic. The Inheritance, the producer Sonia Friedman, has been a long-term supporter of Terence Higgins Trust, and that they did a gala performance on World AIDS Day for us. And I sat there, and the end of the first act, in pieces. I had to get on the stage at the end of the second act. Thank goodness it wasn't the end of the first act. But she says that she's so passionate about HIV because so many of her friends were dying back in the 1980s and early 1990s. Mm. And so she started to fundraise. And that's how she got associated. And that's why The Inheritance was such an important play for her to produce. So there are so many examples of that.
It's a play, for those who haven't seen it, sort of about remembering that we got here today, essentially, because of people who've gone before and lives that have been lost in a very tragic and short way. And actually, you know, we're so quick to sort of dismiss and squabble and be discontented with our lots now. But that sort of remembrance of things past and those that have gone before that have got us to actually a really golden situation now, we have to agree, compared to 20, 30 years ago. We mustn't forget that.
It is a golden situation. But can I go back to my point earlier? Is just, how do you engage people now with the thought of HIV or the knowledge and the facts about HIV when people think it's all right, they've cured it?
So that's about making sure there are the campaigns that are encouraging people to get to know about HIV. Really importantly is mandatory relationships and sex education. That is so important. And that's going to be mandatory in schools in England, all schools in England, in September of 2020. There's a number of schools who are piloting a curriculum. There are so many young people who have no knowledge of good sexual health through the school system. Mm. And that's actually, I think, is a right a child has to have good quality relationships and sex education in schools. The old curriculum was 20 years old. You know, dating apps have come in since then.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's nothing talked about consent. You know, very little about sexual health, very little, if nothing, about HIV. That has to change.
Yeah.
So that's why you'll get people then saying, actually, I understand now that I have a responsibility to look after my sexual health.
Mm.
And actually, I'm empowered to look after my sexual health.
Mm. What was that, a phrase that we coined
an
in one of the...
An
uninformed
child.
It's a vulnerable child. It's a vulnerable child.
Completely.
And I love that phrase. I keep saying it like a mantra.
There's one thing I say.
Yes, boss, I'm going to talk to you now about this. Right.
Well, when I've gone on about, you know, sex education, I did something about, I said, I think children should be taught about porn. I think I said it on the right stuff. And it caused an absolute, you know, hoo-ha amongst Middle England, who were all up in arms saying I was a disgrace who should be locked away. And and that's where I sort of coined that thing. If you think your child isn't watching porn, you're deluded as a parent.
Of course they are.
You know,
they
are. And I said, and to leave your child uninformed is to leave them vulnerable to whatever they see. And I based that on I remember at school, we found an old copy of Razzle in the bushes. It was Razzle or whatever they were called. I can't remember. Not really my sort of thing, but there we go. There it was. And I just remember I'd never seen anything like this before. And I was so horrified, probably for two reasons. One, it really wasn't my thing. But two, that these people were doing this. And it was just, you know, I was a naive little public school boy, you know, and angelic and blonde and sweet and innocent and pure. How I've changed. But it was, I remember being, I won't say damaged, but I've never forgotten the distress of when I saw that. And that's what I sort of mean by that. Mm. Don't think that I was necessarily going to run off and copy what I saw. I was personally distressed that this even existed because no one had told me about it. And it was very shocking.
If that's not happening at home, then it's a responsibility of the state to make sure that's happening with the educational system.
Mm. Mm. No, I completely agree.
But it's taken such a fight to get us. Yeah. It's happening in 2020.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, how long do we have 2020 before we're actually teaching kids about this sort of thing?
Yeah.
It's sort of shameful, isn't it? I mean, there are still a lot of myths, aren't there, around HIV?
Yes.
That exists.
Yes.
I mean, should we test Alex? This is really unfair.
Oh, but
let's,
no, come on, no, it'll be fun. Don't do it to me.
So,
no, because I actually did some research before I got here.
Oh, so you're okay.
But
up.
I had to do some research. So go on, ask me.
I mean, can we cure HIV?
No.
Correct. But can we manage it comfortably?
We can manage it. So in Ian's case, you got that thing where you thought you got the diagnosis, thought you had 8 years, possibly tops.
Exactly.
And you've now lived with the diagnosis for
23 years and got a normal life expectancy.
Do you catch it from loos and towels?
No. I know this.
How do you catch it?
I would have thought it's from having unprotected sex still, isn't it? Is that
mainly,
it?
Yeah.
Is that
That's
mainly?
The main reason, yeah.
I mean, the blood transfusions, those terrible things that we heard of in the 80s, that's long gone.
Not anymore, thank goodness.
Yeah.
But injecting drug users can also contract HIV.
Of course, yes.
Needle stick injuries, very, very rarely.
Very rare.
Very rarely. I haven't actually seen anyone catch it that way. What about pregnancy? Can you have babies if you are HIV positive?
I know this only because I researched it, but it was one of the things that I asked. On Google. I asked Dr. Google because I didn't realise, but you can't you? And how is that possible?
So you go on medication, you have an undetectable viral load, you can't transmit the virus, to your unborn baby. There is still a concern about breast milk.
Right.
And so it's advised for women with HIV not to breastfeed. But you can have a baby without them being HIV positive.
A healthy HIV negative baby, yeah, absolutely you can. And there's no, you know, there's still a lot of, I think, issues about, oh, you're pregnant, you've got HIV, that's terribly irresponsible. Bollocks to that, you know, absolute nonsense. What are the other common myths? Kissing, sharing cutlery, sharing food, all
spitting.
Of that sort of thing. Spitting, that's not how HIV is transmitted. We've done the insurance one. What other common myths do you come across here?
I think they're the key ones, I think. Yeah, it's those, you cannot transmit the virus through normal everyday life. It's mainly sexual contact with somebody who's got a detectable viral load.
Yeah, most importantly, the most profound thing, I think, the change that's happened is that if you are on treatment with an undetectable viral load, you are no longer going to pass it on. And that is huge.
That's news. Huge.
That's huge.
That's massive.
Huge.
Yeah.
And that's where the HIV Commission comes in, which, you know, is the idea that by 2030, there should be no more HIV infections. And that will be based on that idea that you're on treatment that's working. You shouldn't be passing it on.
If you think from 1980, when was the first discovered? It was the end of disco.
Terry Higgins
wasn't it?
Died in 1982.
Right.
One of the first people in the UK.
Yeah. So from that time to 2030, that's quite a short spell. I mean, could you put it in perspective, please?
Cancer's been around forever, and
we're still trying to figure that one out.
We're still trying to figure that one out. Most, you know, the cold, we can't cure. You know, we're rubbish with that. So. Most viruses, we're pretty crap with in medicine, actually, to be fair. HIV, I think, is what the main exception. Although we still can't cure it, the way that we can manage it is profoundly different from most other viruses. You know, we struggle away with the flu, feeling really sorry for ourselves. Not the case with HIV anymore. So that, I hope, gives it some perspective. I can't think of any more profound questions to ask. Ian, can you? I think that's about it for Second Opinion. Alex, as always, thank you. And a huge thank you to my very special guest, Ian Green, from the Terence Higgins Trust, for joining us today and sharing your own personal experience as
Pleasure.
Well as the work of THT. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us by emailing surgery@thepodcastworks.com. You could even, if you enjoyed this podcast, give a donation to THT. How do they do that, Ian?
Go on to Terence Higgins Trust website and there's a click and you can make a donation there.
And you can even do an HIV test.
You can do it. Get a HIV test by the home self-testing kits. Yeah.
So you can even message me on Twitter if you've got questions about HIV. If you just want to have a go at me on Twitter, I can take it. Feel free, give us a 5-star rating if you enjoyed it, share the podcast with your friends. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Imagine
the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.